Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, a podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So today, really delighted to welcome along Rowan, who's both an academic and a practitioner committed to finding ways to extend space for Shakespeare into marginalised communities, including with people with learning disabilities, people with mental health issues, and people experiencing homelessness or imprisonment. As artistic director of Shakespeare and Bard, she's worked in English prisons since 2017 and founded theatre companies in several prisons. These theatre companies are run collaboratively, with each actor having equal ownership and being encouraged to develop positive autonomy, self-confidence, and transferable skills. Rowan's theatre work has been the subject of a PhD, and she's won numerous awards for the quality and effectiveness of her work, including the Prison Learning Alliance Outstanding Individual and the Worshipful Company of Educators Inspirational Educator for Shakespeare. And you were recently shortlisted for a Butler Trust commendation, which I think came in the form of a sonnet. She's a trustee for 1623 Theatre and also Shakespeare consultant for Blue Apple Theatre. She's published and spoken about her work across a range of fields, including criminology, prison education, Shakespeare and applied theatre, and you co-organise the annual Applying Shakespeare Symposium. She's currently establishing a theatre company for those released from prison and also works with children of incarcerated parents. So really quite an extensive commitment to bringing Shakespeare out into communities that might normally not find it all that accessible. So really delighted to welcome you along today, Rowan. Thanks very much.
No, thank you for having me.
That's quite a CV. So I wonder if we could start with a bit of an overview of the kind of theatrical work you've been involved in across your life. I'm guessing that theatre is something you love and find nourishing yourself.
Yeah, so for me, and I was born in a very working class background and was bullied quite badly when I was at school and had absolutely zero self-confidence. So if you'd have said to me when I was at school that I'd be involved in theatre, I'd have probably run away very quickly, as far away as I possibly could. But I always had a love of seeing theatre, and it was always the thing. For me, I can remember my very first experience of reading Shakespeare at school. We looked at Richard II and our teacher got us pushing tables back and standing on them. A health and safety nightmare, wouldn't it? But we were climbing up on tables as Richard and Bolingbroke were vying for who was rising and who was falling in power. And for me, I think that probably started a love affair that's still going on today. Really just an opportunity to see the world a little differently and to escape. And I think one of the things that I love about theatre is the fact that it doesn't necessarily require the sort of filmic qualities that you get with television. You know that you're in a theatre and you can see the other members of the audience, but actually you still release your imagination and see things differently. And I think often that creates this amazing opportunity for heterotopias and for challenging what we think is reality and the norm, and that for me is the really powerful thing about it.
Yeah, so how did you actually get into seeing theatre in the first place?
As I say, I grew up in a sort of working class ex-mining village, actually, and when I went to secondary school, we went to the Crucible in Sheffield to see a couple of productions as part of sort of various school trips, and it just sparked an interest that thankfully my dad then encouraged and would take me sometimes to the theatre. And from that, it spiralled out of there, I guess.
I know you also have a successful other career, which is very different to this theatrical social justice work. So we're really interested to hear about how you came to be offering Shakespeare to marginalised communities in the first place. What made you start thinking this would be a good idea?
I did an undergrad degree in English when I sort of left school and went off to university. And then really needed to leave and get a job because I needed to earn some money. But always had this idea that I would love to do a master's in Shakespeare because it just struck me as the most amazing thing to be able to do, but something far outside of my reaches, and therefore kind of put on the back burner for a long time. And the joys of Google, I have no idea why, but about 8 years ago, I decided to Google whether the Shakespeare Institute at Stratford was still offering amazing Shakespeare, and they were. So I enrolled as a... Actually, I just want to do this. There's no deep and meaningful reason for it. Did a 2 years part-time MA And as part of that, read Murray Cox's book, or Murray Cox edited it, about the actors come hither, Shakespeare comes to Broadmoor. And there was a line in it, and I am misquoting because I haven't got the actual book in front of me, but one of the patients talked about how whatever he'd done for the 50 years of his life on earth, he would only be remembered for the hour that what had happened, and it didn't matter whether he was a good father or a good husband or a good friend. All that anybody would ever remember was the hour when he wasn't. And that really resonated for me. And some of the things in that book, I was probably going doing that tangent that you go down when you're doing academic work and you then find something that's vaguely spuriously connected to what you're meant to be reading and start reading it because it's really interesting. But that book really just stuck with me. And from that, I had a conversation with my supervisor to say, I think somebody really ought to write about this. I think there's this, you know, something about the way that Shakespeare allows people to operate perhaps differently, to think perhaps differently, to look at themselves, but through the lens of a character. And his response was, yes, that's your PhD. And I said, but I don't want a PhD. I've no intention of doing a PhD. I don't want to do a PhD. Anyway, 5 years later, I've done a PhD. So obviously he was right and clearly I was wrong.
I think Shakespeare in English is one of those things that even educationally privileged people can at times struggle with. So I find it quite fascinating that you focused on Shakespeare rather than theatre generally. And I wonder what it is you considered so special about Shakespeare that you thought that would be the way in with marginalised groups.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting question why Shakespeare still appeals 400 and so years later anyway to, you know, so widely, and the universality of his appeal. I think for me, there's probably two things, or probably three things. One is just that I absolutely love Shakespeare, so I'm slightly biased. But the more sensible answers probably relate to, I think one is around his depth of characterization and the complexity and psychological complexity that he writes about, and the timelessness of those characters. So yes, the plays were written 400 and so years ago, but in reality, you know, other themes of jealousy and betrayal and families and, you know, passion and anger and ambition, are they so very different from what we see today? But I think that being able to, for me, textual work offers this dramatic distance in that the improvisational work doesn't always. And I think for some people, if you're struggling to find the words to articulate your space in, actually being able to speak other words that are given to you can sometimes be more helpful than someone sort of saying, well, no, you need to come up with the words. And I think the other part for me, and it's a very double-edged sword, so you do have to be very careful, but it's around the kind of cultural capital with Shakespeare. And that's not to say that it's some sort of panacea that solves all ills or that can be offered as some kind of gift to people that will, you know, enhance their life and improve things for them. But I think certainly the work that I've done personally and been involved in with various different marginalised theatre companies is around using the cultural capital of Shakespeare, the fact that everybody knows who you're talking about. If you talk about Othello, everybody knows who Hamlet is. Most people can misquote a line about a skull and so on and so forth. But I think it's taking that and saying, actually, maybe in the past you felt you weren't able to achieve this. You were told that you couldn't do this. But actually, not only can you achieve it, but you can make it your own. And it doesn't have to sound like, you know, sort of RP pronunciation of Shakespeare as, you know, Laurence Olivier would do. It can sound, you know, as you, and it can be used to explore your story and to express your opinions. And I think for me, that's really important.
Yeah, I found it really interesting that you're talking about the complexity of characters, because I think too often, I think the approach to thinking about certainly criminal justice is really quite a black and white perspective that gets voiced, and it's much harder to think about the nuances of people and the fact that everyone's a mixture of good and bad. So I think it's quite interesting that you hone in on that in terms of Shakespeare. But I was also wondering whether there were any other challenges. So Shakespeare isn't something that necessarily everybody gets straight away, but I wonder whether there were any additional challenges trying to sell Shakespeare to marginalised groups than there might have been to people who've come from a more included section of society.
Yeah, and I think I think partly, certainly if I look at when I set up the Gallowfield Players in H&P Gartree or even in Emergency Shakespeare in Stafford Prison, I think partly it's selling the concept of wanting to become part of something, even regardless of Shakespeare. And I think there's a huge issue with many people who are incarcerated in feeling that they want to trust somebody, in feeling that they want to expose themselves with the potential vulnerabilities that that entails. And certainly theatre does ask people to make themselves vulnerable. You can't get fully engaged in a theatre company if you're not willing to get on your feet, to potentially make yourself look silly, to potentially open yourself up to people having an opinion on what you've said and done and how you've done it. So I think even regardless of Shakespeare, those were sort of some of the initial concerns that people had. And I think there is a lot of people, certainly within the criminal justice system, who have got almost a pathological fear or dislike of formal education, because traditionally that has been used as a way of them being told that maybe they aren't good enough, or that they're not compliant with what somebody wants them to do, or that all of the things that, you know, I know that the two of you know firsthand. So I think very much initially it was about convincing people that actually I was going to keep coming in every week. It wasn't going to be a Shakespeare class. It wasn't going to be a reading exercise. Certainly in the Gallowfield Players, for the first 18 months, we had a gentleman in there who had severe learning disabilities and had a reading age of about 6. But that didn't pose a problem. We worked around it. And, you know, so I think there is that initial fear. But I think there's that initial fear of probably joining any kind of group or collective activity within there. And I think it's only through being able to demonstrate to people that actually, you know, there isn't a right or a wrong way. It's not a test. It's not an exam. Actually, your opinion of what this line means is perfectly valid. And that's the way that I've always approached things. And yes, you have got my dog making very strange noises, and I've no idea why. She's been sat quietly for the rest of the day, but today, you know, now it's like, I need to make weird noises at you. So sorry about that.
That sounds like a whale in the background.
I was struck when we were talking about how powerful that must have felt for that to be, for the men. Is it just men's prisons that you've worked in? I don't know.
It's the male estate that I work in, yeah.
And I was just thinking about how powerful that must be to be offered this as an opportunity, which isn't something that would come along all that often. And I think quite often, my experience anyway, with people in prison is when they're offered something that doesn't come along very often, there is a sense of them realising the preciousness of that. And I can imagine that that would be how they'd have encountered what you were offering.
Yeah, and I think, as I say, certainly if I think to when we started the Gallowfield Players, I think initially there was a lot of reticence, and there were a lot of people who thought it was going to be a kind of taught class, and almost like a GCSE in English or something, which clearly wasn't what we were aiming for. And there was lots of people who thought, oh, but I've never done theatre. I've never acted, so I can't do it. And I'll be honest, I walked around the workshops and recruited people and kind of said, look, you've met me now. I'm not some scary person. I'm not going to do anything horrible. You know, you're not going to be made to feel silly. Just come along and see what you think. And we've grown in size over that 3 years from, I think our first production, we had a cast of 8 of us. So I'm one of the cast. We're now up to 16, which is the maximum number that we can have in the group. So we've not struggled with recruitment since then, to be honest. I think partly that's become word of mouth. So all people that have come to watch a production and then come up afterwards and gone, actually, can I do this? Can I get involved? Which is always wonderful. And that's the best sort of, you know, form of publicity you could ask for, isn't it?
Definitely.
One of the main things that we're interested in is how one creates a kind of culture and climate in a place like a prison that is both creative and builds up people's confidence and sense of their own resilience. So I'm interested to know how it is that you, because I think you've been involved with 3 prisons, Leicester, Gartree and Wakefield.
And Stafford as well.
Oh, Stafford as well. So it's 4. So I was interested to know how you went about approaching each of these prisons and introducing the idea of your project to them?
Yeah, so Leicester was the first prison I ever went into, and I went in as part of the Talent Unlocked Festival. So I'd spoken to the governor and said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could do something? And he said, well, I suppose we could think about it and see what people thought. And so I managed to get myself an invitation to run a two and a half hour workshop back in 2017 as part of their Talent Unlocked Festival. So remand prison with a very high turnover, so you couldn't do anything longer term in there anyway, because the average length of stay is sort of 6 to 8 weeks. So we did a short workshop on Othello, actually, and on dealing with issues of jealousy and who do you trust when your best friend tells you that your partner might not be being true to you, which really resonated with the people that came to that workshop, and we had 12 people involved in that. From that, I managed to get contact with Gartry, and that's where I then managed to arrange a conversation with the governor. At the time, they had two governors in Gartry. It was when there was a shared governorship. And yeah, it was one of the more bizarre moments, pitching to them, could we do Macbeth with all its themes of murder and death in it in Gartry? And they looked at me and said, are you mad? And I went, well, quite probably, but I think it would work. So we agreed that we obviously had to be very mindful of how it felt for people not only involved in the project but also in the audience, and in terms of how we worked. So there was no violence on stage at all in that production. All of the murders happened off stage and were reported, as opposed to anything actually happening on stage and so on. And then from that, I think that started to open more doors. So because Gartry worked and we became a permanent part of what the prison offered, I actually had a phone call directly from the governor of Stafford to say, I've heard about you and I want you to come into my prison and I want you to do this with my people. And then Wakefield again, I was sort of contacted and asked to go in. In terms of working actually with the people in prison and building communities. And I think for me, it's about building communities of trust. And a lot of my work and a lot of my academic research was around the underpinning all of the things that I do by sort of trauma-informed principles, and looking at this idea of building resilience and trustworthiness and peer support and so on. So that's always been fundamental. The theatre companies I'm involved in, it very much is a collaborative effort. So nobody has a more dominant voice than anyone else. Every decision is made collectively. So beyond me going in and pitching an idea to a governor in a prison initially and saying, look, could we do a play? All of the decisions are then taken together. So we choose what play we're going to work on, how we want to edit it, how that might look, staging, costumes, who's invited. The whole thing is done collectively. And one of the most beautiful things about the work that I do is to watch people who have often come in quite shy, quite nervous, quite anxious, and to watch them suddenly get to a point where they can stand up in front of 14 of their peers and walk across and say, oh, actually, no, you need to do it this way. And what about if you try looking this angle as you do it, and start directing each other, and to watch that in a place that often any kind of physical contact would be potentially an issue, and people would take any kind of criticism as an invitation to cause an argument or worse. But to watch people just put all of that aside, because what matters is the performance, and what matters is being the best we can be, is really quite powerful.
You've done tremendously well, Rowan, actually achieving all that. COVID, of course, has been a bit of a hiccup. How have you gone about keeping the idea alive in these institutions?
Yeah, so COVID obviously has caused more of a problem than I even dare to think about. And obviously since March last year, we've not been able to be physically together for rehearsals. So thankfully, in both Gartry and Stafford, they agreed that I could continue to contact the participants and I could send materials in for them, and that they would send work back out and so on and so forth. So it's allowed us to keep things going, not to the same degree, and I'm not silly enough to think that, because obviously there is something wonderful about spending 3 hours a week physically on your feet, acting out and working together. But what I've tried to do is to write in every week, and I've tried to send in about 3 hours worth of activities and pitch them that they can be done individually, but actually if some of them are able to get together on wings in small groups, etc., that actually they could potentially collaborate on those We did manage to, in Gartree, one of the guys in the group is an incredibly talented scriptwriter, far more talented at scriptwriting than I could ever be if I spent the rest of my life trying to do it. And he was working on a production, so taking The Tempest, but almost looking at the prequel to The Tempest, so but called Sycorax's Storm, looking at the idea that every story is driven by how whose perspective you see it from, and that actually there's always a backstory and there's always a different perspective, which is really important. So we were working on this version of Sycorax's Storm, which we were in probably the latter stages of editing. So he'd written most of the work, but peer reviewed by several of the other actors. And we've managed to finish that while we've been in lockdown. So from a combination of 150 handwritten pages of script landing on my desk as I was trying to type up my PhD thesis, that I then had to type up into a proper script and send back. And it's taken us a lot longer than it should have done, but we've got there with it pretty much. And then the final bits will come as we get it on its feet. We start to block out the movements and so on when we are back together. But I think it's been really important for me and for the men that I work with that we've been able to keep that connectivity going. And a number of them have written to me about the fact that it's helped to sustain them, and it's helped to give a shape to the week, because there's 3 hours of theatre to do. There's 3 hours of working on things, and we've done all sorts of things. We've done sort of hot seating characters, looking at how different people have interacted, had an amazing package of costume designs sent through to me that a couple of them had worked on when they'd managed to get some time together, that are just stunningly beautiful. And my next question is, how on earth are we going to get all these costumes put together when we get to perform? But it's given us all a focus to keep that connection going. And I think for a lot of them, it's been a thread through to the future when actually this lockdown ends. Oh, I'd certainly hope it has.
That's remarkable. So would you say you've got a champion within, say Gartree?
Yeah, so I've been very, very fortunate. So official job title is Head of Learning Skills. And so she's been incredibly supportive and has sort of championed that. And I've worked through the Reducing Me Offending team there to make sure that actually we can continue with that happening. In Stafford, we've actually got a number of officers who've been actively involved in the rehearsal work anyway, and actually have played roles in the play. So we've got any number of people who are happy to do printing and sending out in Stafford, which is fabulous as well.
Fantastic. You've obviously put a lot of effort into creating projects that are genuinely egalitarian, and you've touched upon that already. But how easy was it to get all the other participants to commit to this?
To be honest, I've always found it a lot more straightforward than I maybe thought it would be, if I'm honest. So with both of the prison theatre companies, I've sort of gone in and from day one, you know, introduced myself by my first name, shook hands with people. Obviously, I realised we couldn't do that in COVID times, but this was pre-COVID. It was OK. We were allowed to get close to each other without anybody worrying about it. But, you know, shook hands, introduced myself. Always, I think for me, a lot of it is about authenticity, and it's about people knowing that you genuinely want to do this work, and it's not a 3-month project to write some research up, or it's not a, you know, I'm going to turn up some weeks and then not other weeks. So I think that level of commitment's always helped, and I think the fact that they've known that I've come in as an unpaid volunteer for that period of time has also helped. And therefore, I think the response that I've always had from everybody who's gotten involved really has been really positive and has been very much supportive. And a lot of them will talk about, you know, it's their family within the prison. It's their group of people that they can laugh with, they can cry with, they can talk about the happy times, but they can also talk about the times that they find really challenging. And we've probably been through all of those in an average rehearsal, and certainly in the course of a few rehearsals. But I think that's normal if you connect with a group of people and your friendships deepen, and realistically, these are people who are going through very traumatic things and have had great traumas inflicted on them and possibly inflicted great traumas on other people. But actually that in itself carries a sort of emotional weight that I think being able to share collectively, and being able to have something that and one of the guys in the Gallowfield Players said, it's the first time since I came to prison that I've been able to share something that I'm proud of with my family. Not tell them about it afterwards, but actually have them there to be proud of me at the time. And that's really important. And I think that sense of ownership is really positive, certainly from my experience.
Well, one of the things that we found running therapeutic groups in the prison is that actually anything with any piece of paper with something written down can kind of bring up all sorts of recollections of being at school and all the baggage that goes with that. So people who'd often been excluded from school or felt as if they were dumb at school or bullied, and so actually being quite challenging. I think you referred to that earlier, that in some ways getting involved in theatre and Shakespeare in particular could evoke that with the people that you're working with. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think there's always a danger that can happen. And I think that's very much from my point of view, you know, I wouldn't go in and give somebody a script and say, here you go. Because I think certainly not when you, obviously for subsequent productions, yes, it's, you know, they're sort of going, well, where's the script? Can we have it now? But initially it's very much talking about themes, talking about, you know, an overview of what the plot might look like, the story might look like, making it very much that it is inclusive and that everybody's got ideas and drawing on, you know, so if somebody's ambition gets out of hand, how does that impact? And, you know, what kind of things does that evoke? And what you'll often find is that some of the people who maybe would have less confidence in reading, for example, will be the very ones who then come up with some really insightful explanations of how that might feel and how that might look and what might have happened. And then what I've always tended to do in terms of process is to get people looking at maybe some really short excerpts from the play that we're working on, usually the sort of more famous ones. So if you were going to look at Hamlet, you know, obviously it would have to be the famous speech out of that. If you can look at Macbeth, then you're talking, you know, out, damn, spot out. And get them to start working together to translate that into their own language. And if you can put people in, say, small groups of two or three or four people, usually you can make sure there's somebody in there that's quite confident with reading, for example. And actually what comes out very quickly is that everybody's got a view on it. And nobody's right or wrong. And that for me has always been really important. And I think that sort of breaks the ice quite well and gets everybody then feeling like, well, actually, the output of that is I'm part of it. I'm one of those three people. So I'm invested in it personally. And then from there, say, we tend to sort of go through and we'll work through a script, you know, sort of piece by piece. So it doesn't feel overwhelming. I say we've had a number of people in the theatre groups that have had quite severe learning disabilities, people with severe dyslexia, people with memory issues. And a lot of it is just about being very creative in the way that you tackle that and making it feel that actually that isn't an issue and nobody's ever going to be asked to do more than they can do. But equally, sometimes it's nice to be encouraged to maybe push yourself a little bit.
I can see that could be really powerful in terms of helping people rebuild a relationship with education, you know, without coming to associate it with shame, that here's a chance to do it and do it differently this time. And I was also curious because you said at the start about having a working class background, you've got a strong northern accent, and I wondered how much that really helped people engage in a way that maybe they found it less threatening, whereas someone coming in with a more traditionally middle class accent, I wonder whether they would have been received in quite the same way.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. And one of the things that I always say, and any Shakespeare academic that listens to this podcast will probably, you know, immediately want me excommunicating from the world of Shakespeare, but never mind, is that Shakespeare didn't write his plays for academics. He didn't write his plays for the middle class. He didn't write his plays for people that spend £100 and go and watch a lovely production in the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. He wrote his plays for people like you and I, and, you know, when I'm talking to groups, to come and watch. And let's be realistic, you know, that place, that theatre may, you know, tomorrow be a bear baiting pit. It was not exactly high class entertainment. And also, I have no issue with us changing things, with us rewriting bits, with us amending things. So if people have found a particular line too difficult to articulate, we edit it. That's fine. similarly, on the other side of it, and we had a beautiful example when we did Julius Caesar in the Gallifield Players. The guy who wanted to play Mark Antony, so although the play is called Julius Caesar, actually the play is more about Mark Antony. Caesar's dead by the midpoint, so Mark Antony is much more a sort of central figure. Now, he really struggled to read aloud. He would stutter and stumble over his words and really struggled with that. And the education department had told me that, oh, you know, he won't be able to do it. When he came off script, he is a completely different person. And to watch him articulate some of the most beautiful lines, and he was the one who was very adamant that we had to keep the famous speeches in. So Friends, Romans, Countrymen is a classic and it is staying in. And he reduced the audience to tears. It was beautiful as he stood there and spoke the eulogy for his friend. And then you watched him whip the crowd up into this frenzy of turning against the very people that they just hailed as heroes. He's an amazing actor. And I don't doubt for a moment, and we had a couple of professional theatre directors come in and seen as working, who said, actually, without a shadow of a doubt, he'd be accepted into drama school. But he, and I met his mum, and she said, you know, he could barely read when he came inside, and he'd never shown any interest in acting or anything. That wasn't his thing. What have you done? What have you done to my son? But I think that's it sometimes. It's just somebody having that little spark to go, maybe I can do this. And actually, you know, he's incredibly talented.
But I think you touch on a really important theme that's come up in other interviews, actually, that, you know, it's interesting that he, to some degree, he'd been written off. People were saying he can't do this, but actually your belief in him has allowed him to do something that's clearly been quite powerful for him. And certainly a previous guest on here, Michaela Booth, spoke about how important it is to have someone believe in you to give you that sense that you can do something better. So, yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, that's very moving, actually, Rowan. And I used to work on the TC Plus, which is the small therapeutic community for men with learning difficulties. And what you're describing just rings so true, really. Very, very interesting. So in addition to working in prisons and with former prisoners, you're involved in projects in schools and with theatre groups for those with learning disabilities and other mental health issues. What similarities are there in extending theatre into these groups?
I think for me, and the whole, without getting too academic about it, the whole sort of point of why I felt that somebody needed to write my PhD thesis was actually, if we stopped trying to pigeonhole people so often, and we stopped trying to label people so neatly so often, actually it would make life a lot easier for an awful lot of people who are outside of the mainstream. So I think there's often, and there's, you know, some amazing research, some amazing work goes on, you know, with people with learning disabilities in theatre, people with mental health issues in theatre, but everything tends to happen very much in silos. And for me, one of the important things is actually the number of people who are marginalised for multiple reasons. So the number of people with learning disabilities who also then have mental health issues, because we know that social isolation, even under normal circumstances, is significantly higher for those people. That actually living an independent life often is not an option. We know that therefore that will have an impact on their mental health. You know, we know the number of people that are incarcerated that have learning disabilities is disproportionately high in comparison to the general population. Yet there's nothing to suggest that people with learning disabilities commit more crime, but we incarcerate more of them. The number of people with mental health issues within the prison system, or with addiction issues, or who've experienced homelessness or will go on to experience homelessness. So for me, actually, marginalised communities is an important concept to understand, but I think too often we apply labels, and those labels can be stigmatizing. And I think if we can move away from that, so actually that's why my work tries to include a broader section of different marginalized groups, because I don't think it really matters why someone is marginalized. And I think helping them to find a voice and to be able to articulate that in a way that society can can listen to and can hear. And I think those are two different things, is really important.
Sounds like, you know, you referred to cultural capital earlier and kind of engaging people in what is also their own cultural capital, which quite often they've felt excluded and pushed out from, whether that kind of equalises things a little and addresses some of the ways in which they might be excluded from society. So I think, you know, quite often education, culture is used to reinforce people's place, isn't it? And it's kind of like, you don't belong within this, we're not going to allow you the opportunity to engage with this. And therefore that keeps those people as other, whereas what you're doing is really undermining that action, really.
Certainly that's the intention. And at the risk of sort of going over, you know, telling you lots of anecdotes, but I'm afraid, you know, I love talking about the theatre companies because they're amazing. So our last production from the Gallowfield Players, the one that we performed this time last year, actually the very end of January, was The Merchant. So it was based on The Merchant of Venice, but we took the concept of The Merchant. So effectively that Shylock was hated for his Jewish beliefs and for the fact he was a moneylender, and his daughter ran away and stole money from him and eloped, etc. And then the whole sort of infamous court scene with the pound of flesh, and that he could take the pound of flesh but not a drop of blood, or he'd forfeit his life. So when the actors said, can we do The Merchant of Venice next, I must admit there was a small moment in me that went, you want to do a play about religious hatred in a prison, I'm going to have fun selling this one to anybody in any position of authority. And they said, no, we don't want to do that. That's not, you know, we don't want to deal with it in that sense. So our Shylock was, the play opened with him stood at the gates to the prison on the day of his release. He was a released life sentence prisoner. And the stigma wasn't his religion. It was the fact that he'd got this life sentence. So his daughter did run away. We brought it up to date. It was set in modern times. His daughter ran away with her partner and wanted to get married because she wanted to change her name. She didn't want to be associated with him anymore. And we heard about, you know, how visits had felt from both sides, from his side watching his daughter walk away again, how it felt from her side when her mum died and he was inside and wasn't there to support her. And then we kept the famous speech. So the, you know, if you prick me, do I not bleed? And that has a very different resonance when it's spoken by a man serving a life sentence, and it's spoken to his own mum and to the governor of the prison and to people from the Royal Shakespeare Company and the Royal Opera House. And I don't think there were many dry eyes in the house as he spoke those lines, but it was really an opportunity for us as a collective to be able to say, well, actually Shakespeare gives us a way of looking at this that doesn't feel fairly solipsistic. It doesn't feel fairly, you know, oh, poor me. It feels very much like actually we need to bring these things to the front. And we also were able to bring in issues around self-harm and around suicide rates within the prison system. And we had a number of inmates came to us afterwards and said, thank you, you've made me realise that actually I can talk to someone about this and that I shouldn't be ashamed that I've self-harmed or that I do self-harm. And I think for me that was really powerful. But I think being able to use this vehicle, and Shakespeare was the vehicle for that, but to be able to mould and adapt it really gave people an opportunity to bring to light some very current relevant issues, as well as some of the traditional Shakespeare characters as well.
Really powerful anecdote, and you can really hear your passion and the impact that the work has on you at the same time, that sense of being moved by it. Clearly, that comes through in your description.
You're obviously very, very clever at the way you present these things, because you must be aware that there's tremendous anxiety within the prison system about not just racial conflict, but religious tensions, particularly relating to Muslim offenders. And I would imagine that the prison governor must have thought of that straight away. How are we going to avoid inflaming the population of the prison?
Yeah, and I think that's, it's also a difficult one, isn't it? Because to some degree, you don't want to tackle issues that are, clearly you don't want to tackle issues which are going to inflame the population, but certainly within the group. And I think for me, there's two elements to it. One is what we talk about in a group setting and in rehearsal, and actually we can tackle, we have spoken about religion and we've got multiple religions, we've got multiple nationalities involved in the theatre company, you know, that there's very few topics that there wouldn't be the trust to be able to talk about those and to debate those, but without arguing and without that becoming personal, which I think is really fundamental. And I think that's one of the things that the theatre company actually is incredibly good at, is helping people with negotiation skills and to understand differences of opinion and to probably deal with those differently to how they maybe would have done in the past, where we know that often violence would have been the outcome of that. I think in terms of the wider population and in terms of, you know, people coming to watch a production, we do have to be very mindful of that. And so we as a collective will always talk about how we might deal with those things, how it might be perceived, whether anyone could take our storyline but actually have interpreted it differently to how it was meant and what that might happen. And I think that's really, it is really something that you have to be very mindful of in that environment. And there's no getting away from that. But equally, I think we've, touch wood, over the last 3 years managed to tread that fine line and to keep, you know, some of the conversations have probably been much deeper and much more open than we would put in a production. But actually that's okay, because that's in the safe space where that's understood.
There's another fine line that you're managing to walk there as well, in that, you know, from Joe Public's point of view, prisoners can't be seen to be having too much fun. And yet I imagine that people do get a lot of pleasure out of the activity. So I think there's something about how you manage to also engage the authorities in doing something that could be construed as a hobby and enjoyment, but managing to convince the authorities that there's something actually much deeper and much more worthwhile going on with it.
And absolutely, all of us, you know, all, and I include myself in that as well, we love rehearsals. It's a time for people to be able to have fun and to laugh and to joke. But actually that doesn't mean that learning isn't taking place. If anything, that means that people are more open to learning. And I think, you know, the skills that people are able to acquire, and it's not the skills that we give them, because you choose whether you want to take something from anything that you do, you know, but realistically, regardless of certain tabloid newspapers, people who are in prison will come back out and be members of our society again, and we'll live next door to somebody again, and we'll hopefully have a job and all of those things. And I think if we ostracize people and we don't allow them to find personal development and we don't allow them to move forward and to find productive outlets and creative outlets, actually we're just in a position where we're effectively damning them to reoffend, because there will be nothing else. So I feel very passionately that whatever anyone has done, we take the deprivation of your liberty is the price you pay for conviction. It should not be the deprivation of your humanity.
Absolutely.
Your PhD must have occupied a lot of your time and energy over the last few years. Can you tell us a bit about its findings?
Absolutely. So yes, I think it becomes an obsession. I think that's normal if you do a PhD. I think that's what has to happen. So, and certainly when you're doing a part-time PhD and have a full-time job and several theatre companies. So for me, as I say, it was very much about not looking in silos at different groups of marginalisation. So I based it around a theoretical framework around spatial theories. So looking at spaces of creativity and rehearsal, spaces for performance, looking at reflective spaces and individual reflections on work that had been done, and then also on media spaces and how the voice that is heard is often not the voice that is speaking. So for me, some of the key highlights that came out, some of the sort of main themes, were about the heterotopic value and potential of theatre and what happens when you put together Shakespeare with all its inherent cultural capital, but with a group of people that people maybe traditionally have thought wouldn't be able to either be the actors or wouldn't enjoy the production, if you look at the Broadmoor examples. But also what happens in terms of the importance of longevity of projects and the fact that actually I believe that a lot of arts funding should be longer term, because going in and doing something for a couple of weeks, yes, it's great and it's a nice taster to do something and you might feel lovely about doing it, but the long-term fundamental changes to patterns of behaviour or the long-term development of independence and resilience takes a significant time period. And then, as I say, also looking at in terms of sort of reflection and self-reflection. So drawing on all sorts of examples like the Robben Island Shakespeare and Mandela and so on, looking at examples from Second World War prisoner of war camps and how they drew on literature as a way of connecting with their own society during a time of exile. And then, as I say, finally looking at the sort of media side of things and how actually any story, whether it's as simple as me recounting something to you that happened earlier today, or whether it's a full-blown, you know, filmed documentary, always has a view and it always portrays a specific view on it, and how the media can be both supportive or incredibly destructive, and probably prison theatre is the one that has those most extreme examples in there.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. So how do you see your plans for bringing theatre to socially marginalised groups evolving in the future?
So my plan, my hope, is that it will continue to grow and to become a more central part of my working life, definitely. I've just set up a few weeks ago Beyond the Walls, which is a theatre company based in South Yorkshire for people who've had experience of the criminal justice system, of people who've experienced, doesn't necessarily need to be people that have served custodial sentences, but people who are marginalised in various ways. And the intention is that that will offer people the opportunity upon release or as they're trying to get things back on an even keel in life, the opportunity to belong to something like those theatre companies that I have the pleasure of being involved in on the inside, and to have that, you know, 3 or 4 hours a week that is my time to do something creative and that's outside of the regime of maybe my, you know, my job, which might be quite isolated, or I'm looking for work, etc. And also will help with skills like, you know, public speaking and self-confidence and self-worth and all of those things. I'm in talks with several other prisons once COVID hopefully is under some more control about looking to expand the programmes and do more work both inside and outside, because I genuinely think this offers people an opportunity for those people who want to do it. And I get that for lots of people, theatre isn't their chosen medium, but for lots of people, it is a way of expressing themselves and often a way of using that palette of emotions in a positive way, as opposed to that palette of emotions being quite self-destructive to them or to the people that they're in close contact with.
That sounds fascinating. Sounds like it'll bring more success as well, hopefully, to a broader range of people. But the final question that we tend to ask people, Rowan, is we ask people about something that provides them with nourishment. And I guess for you, that's obviously Shakespeare. I mean, you speak so passionately about it. But I wondered if there's anything particular that you would draw listeners' attention to that you find particularly supportive and nourishing from your studies.
Oh, that's an interesting one. And actually, I'd thought of something that wasn't Shakespeare, just because I don't want to only ever be able to talk about Shakespeare.
Pigeonhole you, by all means, choose something else.
There's probably two things. One is a book that I would highly recommend to anyone, a book by Nikita Gill, who writes Poems of Rebellion, Fire and Beauty. So her book of Wild Embers is a simply stunning read. It was actually recommended to me by one of my actors on the inside, and it has some really, really powerful poems of strong characters and strong women and, you know, upending some of those fairy tale stories and really making them a bit more gutsy. And it really resonates with me. The other thing that I would like to be really cheeky and ask if I could share is actually something that one of the actors wrote, because I think it's only fair that they get to have their say as well. And unfortunately, they're not able to be on this podcast, but I can be their mouthpiece in my Northern accent, if that's all right.
Yeah, go for it.
So it was actually an unprompted piece entitled Experiencing Freedom Within the High Security Estate. In a recent conversation, I was asked why I would want to attend a prison drama group. Was it not embarrassing to stand up on stage and perform in front of people? I could only answer each part of that inquiry in turn. Firstly, unless you ever attend the group, it is difficult, perhaps even impossible, to grasp the depth of feeling that is attached to it by all involved. For a few short hours every week, we are free. Although physically we remain within the boundaries of the prison, our spirits soar far above the walls and fences. Our minds are so involved in what we do that we could be in any room, on any stage, anywhere in the world. This is a true sense of freedom, and one that is rarely found anywhere in life, let alone within the high security estate. It offers each of us a few brief moments of nirvana. The weekly group provides a safe and supportive space in which we can express ourselves. It's the space in which honesty exists and the truth is used not as a weapon to beat us down, but instead to empower and encourage each and every one of us that is involved. We get the opportunity to be occasionally irreverent without the fear of institutional retribution, and our combined coping mechanism of gallows humour is appreciated as humour, not seen as some manifestation of criminal deviancy. Our weekly sessions allow us to have an opinion and a voice so that it can be heard. Not all of our ideas are achievable, but in the group they are considered, and this alone helps to build self-confidence and raise self-esteem. We are treated as equals, as people. This is often an alien concept within the penal system. Upon crossing the threshold of prison, we instantly become less. We are stripped of our clothes, our dignity, our humanity. Our lives prior to incarceration instantly rendered worthless. All of our experience and our knowledge debased. However, within the setting of the theatre company, these trends are reversed and the prison standards turned on their head. The group is a cooperative endeavour. This means that all involved have a sense of ownership of it. At times, a possessiveness over this beautiful organism that grows in unexpected and wondrous ways. This means there's a sense of responsibility bestowed on everyone to act in a certain manner, to promote the best us that we can be in order to reap the rewards this initiative has to offer. With the ownership and responsibility comes anxiety and self-doubt because it is valued so highly, and the pain of doing anything that would let others down is a small price to pay for the benefits of the ownership and the camaraderie. As for the second part of the question, in prison, are we not all actors playing the part we need to, depending on which setting we're in? Offender management unit and psychology expect one set of behaviours. Survival on the wing requires another. Family another, workshops and education still a different set. And many cannot be themselves or lose themselves in the tangled web the penal system weaves. For some, an escapism from the mind-numbing reality of prison life is in the characters played. And even if there is an embarrassment in standing in front of your peers and acting, a small moment or two of discomfort is nothing when compared to the hours and hours of pleasure experienced. All I can say is this is the closest thing I've experienced to freedom in prison without being in the arms of my loved ones. And to all the doubters and naysayers, just don't knock it till you've tried it. I think he says it far more eloquently than I can. That's why I felt that it was appropriate to share that.
That phrase that he included in there, having a voice and being heard.
Yes, it's really powerful, isn't it? To be able to speak and to be listened to and to have your voice heard is incredibly powerful.
Yes, definitely. That was lovely. Really, really enjoyed talking with you, Rowan. Fascinating conversation. But what really comes through is your passion, but also the commitment from all the people that you've worked with and how you're taking them to different places with that. Really brilliant interview. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, but no, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. It's, you know, it's something that obviously is very, very close to my heart. And they're wonderful. My life is much richer for being part of the theatre companies. I think they feel the same, I'd hope so.
Well, I think that really comes through from how you talk about it. And that's one of the things that we wanted to do with the podcast is to be able to showcase some of the really positive things that happen in difficult environments, because too often I think what gets drawn attention to is the really difficult things, and really nice to see the parts of humanity that don't get associated or seen when it comes to talking about certainly prisons of all places. But thank you, really, really generous of you to give us so much of your time today.
No, not at all. It's been a real pleasure and obviously great to meet you, or sort of meet you. Hopefully we physically will at some point.
And lovely touch at the end, hearing from one of the participants. So, you know, such powerful words, and to be able to include that voice, I thought was was really quite special.
Yeah, it was all very powerful and very moving, I thought. And right at the beginning, she introduced this phrase, looking at yourself through the lens of a character. And I thought, well, that just about sums up what she's doing with these guys. She's engaging them to think about themselves and doing it through the play. So it was really clever. I was interested as well, because it's the second time in a few weeks we've heard Murray Cox's name mentioned. Gwynedd and trained with him, was very influenced with him. That was it.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music. You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.